Okay, our next presenter is Dr. Moretu, if I said that right,
yes.
Who's a philosopher at this university. He'll be talking on mirror neurons, empathy, intersubjectivity, and the second-person perspective with implications for the problem of consciousness. And he's going to do that all in 20 minutes.
Right, I think that's the hope, but I don't think I'll be able to cover everything. Should I? What am I supposed to do?
Press F5 on the keyboard.
Oh, 5. Okay.
F5. Okay.
Yep. Okay. Then
down arrow, right?
Yeah, okay. All right. I'm not going to cover lots of things that I would have loved to cover about mirror neurons. Especially, I'm going to ignore completely the methodology that neuroscientists use. Things like TMS or transcranial magnetic stimulation or PET scan or positron emission
tomography.
Those are the two top methodologies that neuroscientists use in order to understand better the properties of mirror neurons. My own interest with respect to mirror neurons is related to the philosophical ramifications of the work of neuroscientists. Some of the things that I believe as a philosopher who is madly interested in the philosophy of neuroscience and philosophy of physics, I just want to point out some areas where I think neuroscientists haven't paid attention. I'm not faulting them, but it's just not something that they often spend time thinking about. So philosophers look at what they do and say, well, that place, I really don't think the implication or the assumption is sound or something like that. So this is not an attack on mirror neuron research. It's a friendly approach and critique and evaluation or observations that I think might be helpful for all of us. Okay. This is the abstract, so I'm not going to read this. This is kind of, when you even look at it, like, it's so scary. So I would like to begin my talk by kind of taking a question that was used as a title of the book written by Nancy Murphy and Warren Brown. Their book is called Did My Neuron Make Me Do It? Did my neurons make me do it? Well, I think if you carefully look at this question, I have modified it and said, well, let's say this, did my neurons make me do it? Okay, so what comes out of this question? What's embedded within this question itself? I'd like to point out something. So I just want to say this question, let's say the neuron question. So the neuron question, we can actually infer two things from this. One would be, linguistically speaking, if you look at the pronouns, for example, like my, it's a kind of possessive determiner. You can just say that X is mine or Y is mine or something like that. You can even understand it as a possessive case of the first person pronoun I. So whereas the word me is used often by a particular speaker to refer to himself or herself as an object of a verb or a proposition. So this is not a very interesting part, linguistic. I mean, I'm not that much interested in the grammatical or linguistic part of it. But then when we come here, we can ask a very important question that will come later on to infer, from which I would be inferring that a serious ontological implication from this point. Let's talk about the distinction. So Francisco Suarez is a medieval period, a very distinguished Jesuit philosopher and theologian. He introduced various notions of distinctions. One of the two top distinctions that were usually used by philosophers to make various kinds of points are real distinction versus the distinction of reason. So when you look at the real distinction, take, for example, any given two objects, X and Y. So if I say, for example, X is distinct from Y, if I'm using the sense of real distinction, what I mean by that is I'm implying that X is a different kind of entity from Y and vice versa. So turn that into another kind of distinction, the distinction of reason. If you say, for example, using the latter version of distinction, the distinction of reason, you are not actually making any inference about the distinction between X and Y being two different entities, but you're simply taking them to be the same kind of entity, but you're conceptually making a mental distinction between X and Y. But at the end of the day, X is not going to be Y, and vice versa. Okay, so this distinction is extremely important for our purpose. Okay, now you can also infer, not only the distinction between, I just want to point out one thing. When I talk about, I don't know whether I might have skipped something, because the distinction has to do with the distinction between oneself and one's neuron. So that's the distinction. So is there a distinction between oneself and one's neurons that are making up that person's nervous system, for example? Okay. So that distinction is extremely important. Okay. Now, the mirror doctrine now, before we look at that, we can ask this question as well. Neurons play a certain role or certain roles, but what's the nature of this role? What can we say about the role of the nature of this role itself? So two things. From did my mirror neurons make me do it? I have inferred two things. One is the distinction between implication for the distinction between oneself and one's neuron. The second one is what is the role of the nature of the role of those distinctions. Okay, so the doctrine of mirror neurons. Very, very basic stuff, right to the point. No time to waste. Okay. The mirror doctrine came, historically speaking, in the 90s by a group of Italian philosophers and neuroscientists. And they did this research on monkeys, especially on the prefrontal area, where the neuroscientists called them F5. So what they have found out from their experiment is two important properties. I call them like functional properties. These are the properties, and we can claim them to be like two central claims. Actually, these are the foundation of the doctrine of mirror neurons. The rest is simply filling out the details, all right? So here are two pillars that really support the doctrine of mirror neurons. And the first one is mirror neurons respond or fire when someone reaches for an object in a goal-oriented manner. The second one is mirror neurons also fire or respond when someone watches another person reach out for an object. So they fire when I actually hold a certain object. They also fire in your brain when I see you holding the same object, for example. It goes both ways. So these properties are extremely unique and very, very interesting, because we will look at them later on. But then here is what is being inferred from those two properties. One is there's a sense in which philosophers and neuroscientists, they say there's an instance of action execution. When I actually hold a certain object, there's mirror neurons fire in my brain, which means I'm executing a certain action. Not only that, when I observe another person doing the same thing, I will be in a position to understand the action of another person. So hence, action understanding. So the two properties that we looked earlier are now summed up by action execution and action understanding. Okay. So there are some remarkable features of mirror neurons. So those cells don't simply fire or respond, but they are very, very selective and picky. And it reminds me of my own childhood years when I used to be picky and I need this food and that kind of thing. So you might have experienced that in your life as well, if you're like me. So they are very picky. So there is what neuroscientists tell us, that they respond for precision grip. Let's say, for example, for a piece of Lego, okay? So you just use your fingers and just precisely grip a very, very tiny object. And there are a special class of cells in the nervous system, if this theory is true, then they respond. Not only that, there are other kinds of cells that really would respond for a whole hand grip as well. When I, for example, grasp an orange or a coffee mug, you know, there are cells that respond for that. But keep in your mind, the cells that respond when I actually grasp a raisin are not the same cells that would really respond when I actually, you know, grasp an orange. So this raises a very interesting thing. Are they really aware of what I'm doing? Are they conscious? It's just very, very mystifying stuff. So, and they are also said to be, for example, they do not respond, for instance, if you simply make some kind of meaningless gesture, like that, for no purpose. They're going to protest. They don't really react. They're just stiff, and just like that. They don't respond for that. So somehow, if this theory is true, they really recognize whether a particular gesture is goal-oriented or meaningless, right? For the meaningless one, they don't. For a goal-oriented one, they do. This is very interesting, right? So mirror neurons are said to be responsible also for unifying various kinds of mental properties, all right? So I think a very important psychologist and neuroscientist, Ramachandran, if I'm pronouncing his name very correctly, and he in fact made a very interesting claim that what DNA has done for biology, mirror neurons would do for, you know, unifying mental properties. That's a very interesting claim. So they are also are being understood in terms of being unifiers, okay? So if they are unifiers, then they take a role of bearing certain properties, for example, okay? I'll talk about that later on. So these are very interesting features, and these are not the only features of mirror neurons. There are a host of other new features, but I'm not going to get into that. So we can actually compare that to another prominent view in neuroscience called global workspace theory, which was put out in the latter part of 1980s, by a neuroscientist called Bernard Barthes. Very, very influential theory. So in a nutshell, this theory actually introduces a mechanism in our nervous system where all information from all parts of our brain comes and sort of congregates in a particular place, not region, not a structure, somewhere from which information starts like disseminating outward. It goes to other regions of our brain such that we end up accomplishing or carrying out different kinds of tasks. So there's a kind of interesting link to mirror neurons, but I've never read people linking a global space theory to mirror neurons, but I'm just kind of making this some kind of exploration here. So Hickok, by the way, I have his book here, recently wrote, he's a neuroscientist at the University of Riverside, Irvine. So he came, he wrote a book by challenging everything that I've enthusiastically have introduced for you, right? I just didn't know what to do with myself, you know. I was just jumping up and down. But he said, "Well, not too fast." So he wrote a book entitled "The Myth of Mirror Neurons." Okay, so he thinks that the last number of research that have been done since 1990s are very problematic in his view. He doesn't say that in a kind of arrogant way. He just tries to show why he thinks this core research are deeply problematic. I'm not going to discuss his view, but I would like to point out some of the things that he says. And I just want to run to my own objections that I would like to introduce later on. So, is all well with the doctrine of mirror neurons or research? Well, we have two different positions. One would be, well, we're making a tremendous progress, and we are moving forward, and we're so excited. There are certain questions that we have got to solve, and certain modifications that we have to introduce to what has already been done. So we are doing great.
So yeah!
Yeah, okay, so excitement is high on that part. On the other hand, others would say, people like Grigory Hickok himself, not. The achievements that we've claimed we've made over the past 30 or whatever years, or 20 plus years, are not good reason to get excited. So this can't kind of give us a kind of somber picture of what's happening here. So what is the issue that Hickok takes with this things that that have been accomplished so far? So he points out a number of problems. Some of them are kind of philosophically based. Most of them are empirically based. So he's not a philosopher. So he's a neuroscientist, but he helps himself very well by looking into the philosophical ramifications and the inferences made from monkey research directly to human being. How does that inference work? What is the logic behind that? He has worries about the inference itself, but then he has some kind of interesting worries from empirical point of view. One would be no direct evidence in monkeys that mirror neurons support action understanding. So this is scary because the whole house of the mirror neuron doctrine is erected on two assumptions. One would be understanding the actions of other people and executing certain actions. So there are special kinds of cells in my nervous system or in my brain that would react when I do that. So pull those assumptions away, the house of mirror, the doctrine of mirror neurons collapses. So there's absolutely no foundation. So now he attacks the very first assumption. Now he says we do not need mirror neurons for action understanding, even more scarier. We don't even need it. This is not a philosophical conjecture. He appeals to his own lab research to challenge this idea. So mirror neurons in monkeys and mirror-like responses in humans are different, he says. So mirror neurons are believed to be in Broca's area in human beings and in monkeys in prefrontal lobe and premotor cortex area. So he raises a very interesting objections. Monkeys do not really speak language, and we do. And Broca's area is, for the most part, is responsible for language production. And Wernicke's part is, for the most part, is Wernicke's. Is that right, Wernicke's? Wernicke's. Is for language perception, right? So even the regions are different. They are not in the same region. So Hickok is an expert in language, in a speech perception and language itself. So he challenges this theory from his own lab research point of view. So the other point he raises is in humans, action execution and action understanding come apart, dissociate. So this is very scary. If this is true, then this is not a good news for the mainstream mirror neurons view. The other interesting claim would be damage to where the human mirror system is believed to exist, Broca's area, does not cause action understanding deficit. This is a very, very interesting objection. So this is like very serious, right? If Broca's area is responsible for mirror neurons, when that region is damaged, I'm still capable of understanding what other people are doing, so the deficit is not there. Therefore, what's the basis of that claim? Okay, so that's what these are some of the objections that he raises. Now, if his objections are true, then what this implies is that his objections really pose a very serious obstacle to fundamental assumptions of the doctrine of mirror neurons, which means neuroscientists have got a big project in their hands, so they have to either go back to the drawing table or they have to respond to objections like this, both on philosophical ground and empirical ground as well. Now, I'm going to jump to my own worries, because I have worries as well, so why should I simply kind of preach what somebody has said? So that's not fair. So now, here are my worries, and I'm very, very selective about my worries. The first one is this, so I have 5 minutes. The doctrine of mirror neurons does not address central ontological issues with respect to the distinction between one's brain and one's self. How are we supposed to understand this distinction? In the sense of the real distinction, is brain distinct from me, or am I identical to my brain? Okay? You've got to think about that very seriously. Or in the in the sense of the distinction of reason. If in the sense of the distinction of reason, then I am my brain. But the problem and the paradox that comes right away is my brain is part of me. So it really violates the mereological principle, the part-whole relation. So it seems false to say that if my brain is my part of my body, then I cannot really be my brain, right? So there's a kind of the me, the my is this kind of ugly pronounced kind of hanging around, and we need to understand the logic behind those pronouns. So my claim is not linguistic at all. It's ontological claim, all right? It's not grammatical claim at all. It's ontological, it's metaphysical. So am I fundamentally my brain or else blank? Well, up to you to feel that blank. So everyone is struggling to feel this blank, and you know, I'm not going to give you an answer, but it's a very serious question. All right, so feel in that. And then defend your claim. Now, the second problem I would like to point out in mirror neuron research, please understand I'm not against the research, I'm not against the science, and that's not my point. I've already made my motivation in critiquing this view. I'm simply saying these are missing elements, and I believe these are important elements that should be taken very seriously. The second one is this. The doctrine of mirror neuron confuses the nature of the role of neuronal activity and neuronal pattern with what is being correlated as a result of such activity. So I don't have time to flesh this point out, but I think it should be clear. In other words, this doctrine faces the explanatory gap problem. The explanatory gap problem is the idea would be, how is it possible because of however my nervous system works? I don't care how it works, but I end up having a very rich phenomenology. How is that happening? You're not going to succeed in explaining that by telling me again, neurons fire, about neurotransmitters, about chemical signals and electrical signals. That will not help me. I know that. Thank God, that's good. But why, as a result of that, I'm having rich phenomenology? Those are very distant questions. You cannot really help yourself by telling me the same thing all over again without really facing this. So I do believe that the mirror neuron doctrine faces the explanatory gap problem. And it's a very, very important problem. You can take it metaphysically, you can take it epistemologically as well, but I take it metaphysically. The doctrine of mirror neurons does not address the complex relationship that exists between the first person perspective and the second person perspective, which allows us to engage in empathy, and the limitations besetting the second-person perspective. So I have published myself in detail about these issues, so I think it's not possible for me to get into that now. But it is worth thinking about this. So earlier, excellent presentation was given about empathy and so on. I wholeheartedly agree with that. But there are awful lot of complexities that surround empathy itself. I have so much things to say, but it's just not fair. Life is not fair. The world is not fair. Okay, let me. So the doctrine of mirror neurons could be misleading, in fact, because it tends to fit a bewildering array of mental properties and capacities into two stringent categories, namely the category of understanding X and the category of executing X. This theory both leaves out a class of mental activities people engage in, plus it underdescribes a host of other mental phenomena as well. So it is absolutely not convincing to me to say that simply because they fire when I see you holding or grasping an object, when mine fire when you see me do likewise, it doesn't follow from that. My entire experience can't be somehow boxed in that. This is not right. This is false. This is a very, very serious counterexample. And I can mention so many things. Thinking about number two. Just sitting on my couch and thinking about number two. You see me and nothing fires in your brain. I'm not doing any action. I'm not grasping anything, but thinking about number two. Heaven, Jesus, God, Trinity, whatever. What would you say about my experience? You have nothing to simulate in your brain. I'm not making any movement. So, talking with yourself. So there are so many things that you can bring in. So why is it neuroscientists are so much consumed because of these two properties that they are unifiers. They just make mirror neurons as if special kinds of cells. And the properties you attribute to mirror neurons should be attributed to other regions of our brain as well. So I'm actually going to finish. The properties attributed to mirror neurons raise the question of consciousness. But what is consciousness? Right? Everything that you say about mirror neurons, the features and the properties are all, they raise consciousness. So the problem is really not about mirror neurons. The problem that people talk about mirror neurons is just scratching the surface. It's just the tip of the iceberg. What is underneath is a bewildering, a very scary question. What is consciousness? So I really think that the nervous system, either individually or corporately, the neurons are not conscious. So the brain is not conscious as a whole. To think otherwise would be to commit actually what Bennett and Hacker say, neurological fallacy. In other words, that the fallacy of swapping the property or capacity of the whole with its part. So I do think the last point is this. Mirror neurons, in my view, do not solve the well-known problem in neuroscience, the binding problem. I'm looking at all of you here. Everything that I'm experiencing in this room is unified to me. I do not experience you in abstraction from him or from the table, from every object. Everything is unified in my visual field. Why? Who is unifying it? And how is it that kind of experience is possible for us? So this raises a different kind of ontological problem. The bearer of this experience cannot be the firing of neurons. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't fire. If they don't fire, I can't have this experience. It's not to belittle the importance of neurons. If they don't fire, I'm out. I'm dead. So I need them. They should fire. Please, thank God. I mean, make them fire all the time. That's not the point. But because they fire, I'm having this experience. And why? And that raises fundamental question about what kind of entity am I? You see? Conclusion. Mirror neurons may well exist, but in the case of human beings, the jury is still out. But neuroscientists talk about mirror system, not mirror neurons when it comes to us. Now, okay, they may well exist, but they need not be eulogized in my view. The fundamental issue we run into dealing with mirror neurons is not just the understanding action and the executing action dynamics, rather it is accounting for the nature of consciousness. So mirror neurons are symptoms of rather a much bigger issue that involves the problem of an irreducible consciousness for which neither appeal to a particular region in the brain nor to a nervous system as a whole seems to be capable of providing us with any satisfactory solution. I'm not the only person to argue that way. David Chalmers is one of the world's leading thinkers on this issue. I was at the University of Arizona 2 months ago at the international conference, one of the largest international conference on the nature of consciousness, and it really brings 600 scholars, physicists, chemists, biochemists, you name anything, any discipline that ever existed on the face of the earth. People are there. Here is the consensus. People are not really making any bogus claim, even though there are many, many bogus proposals. But they are saying we are maybe beginning to ask right questions about the problem of consciousness, let alone to have solved the problem. So I'd like to say that the doctrine of mirror neurons should really take the problem of consciousness very, very seriously. And the problem lies here, in my view. Thanks for listening to me. And
one quick question.
Oh, yeah, I was at that Tucson conference. In fact, I've been, I think, to all of them. And the opinion of many is that before we understand consciousness, we have to understand the neural correlates of consciousness.
Right.
And that will probably take about another 100 years.
Maybe more.
Mm-hmm. And when we understand that, then maybe we'll get a sprinkling of an idea of how consciousness comes from the neurons.
Maybe.
So let's be patient, and the magic word is humility.
Right.
Which I'm not hearing very much at ASA.
Yeah, that's right. We should wait. And there are two things that I can say. There's no guarantee that we would succeed, right? But it is always important to give that room. Absolutely, I completely agree with that. Yeah, definitely.
That's what I'll be talking about tomorrow about this time. So
I would definitely listen to your talk because you came to listen to my talk. Otherwise, it wouldn't be fair. Yeah, definitely. So, thanks.